Welcome to Writers with Wrinkles, where authors Beth McMullen and Lisa Schmid iron out the wrinkles in writing, publishing, and everything in between, one podcast at a time.
Have you ever dreamed of running away to London and getting to walk in the footsteps of Shakespeare and Dickens? If your answer is yes, you'll want to stick around and hear all about how one author did just that. Stay with us, and we'll be right back. Today, we are thrilled to welcome author Elizabeth Uhlberg to the podcast. Elizabeth was born and raised in Wisconsin before moving to New York City to work in the publishing industry. While she got to work with amazing authors as a publicist, she also once had to play basketball dressed in a Clifford the Big Red Dog costume. She is the author of novels for teens and young adults, including internationally best-selling YA novels, The Lonely Hearts Club and Better Off Friends, and the acclaimed Great Shelby Holmes middle grade series. The second book in her newest Scared Silly series is Scared Silly number 2, Zombie Wedding Crashers, and this is out now. Elizabeth lives in London, where she spends her free time going on long walks around her favorite city in the world and eating all of the scones, which is something that I can totally relate to. So I was reading that bio and I was like, yeah, baked goods. That's my downfall.
Carbs. They it's what moves us.
Carbs of any sort. Give me white flour and I'm a happy person. So I remember I first met you when your first Great Shelby Holmes middle grade book was coming out, and my first middle grade Mrs. Smith Spy School for Girls book was coming out. And I remember distinctly you talking about this move to London and this particular kind of visa that you had gotten. And I had never heard of this, and it just kind of blew my mind. So if you don't mind kind of talking about how you came to be where you are right now, I think that would be so interesting for our listeners, because I know every writer secretly wants to live in London.
I mean, we have a really good history, and it is the other day I finally went to the Globe. So I was at the Globe, and then afterwards I said to my friend, oh, let's go to this really old pub that used to be an inn in which not only did Dickens once stay in, but Shakespeare. And that like blew my mind. I've been in plenty of pubs where Dickens has been because the man liked his pints. But to be like in the same place as Shakespeare, because the Globe is a new building, a reimagining of the original. It's just you are constantly walking in the footsteps of literary greats here in London. And it's so amazing. And so I get nervous telling you this, Beth, because you have a son who is studying abroad here. But my love of London began when I studied abroad in London back in college.
I fully expect for him never to come home. Like, I'm like, okay, well, he lives there now.
Yeah, I've always loved it. And I started coming back more. I have a friend who has a flat here that he was like, you know, he lives in Ireland. He was like, if you ever, you know, want to come to London and I'm not using it, you're welcome. And I just started spending more and more time here. And and I just was like, the first time I came, it was like 10 days. Second time was like 3 weeks. And every year I just kept spending more time. And being a writer, we can work from anywhere. And I decided to look into getting something called a global talent visa, which is for artists. And you have to get an endorsement by the Arts Council in the UK, which requires 3 letters of recommendation. One has to be from a UK-based company. And then you have to show proof that you are a writer, you've written work, that your work is of merit. You know, I had reviews of some of my books. I've had, I used interviews. My books do really well in the Spanish language market. So I use those where I had to have a I've had to have it verified, translated. And I got a visa, which allows me to live here. But one of the best perks, especially when you're self-employed, of living in the UK is I get to partake in their wonderful NHS, their National Health Service. So when I was thinking, is it silly for me to move to London? I broke it down of, well, I no longer have to pay the nearly $700 a month I was paying for my health insurance premium. There is a tax surcharge, but it was less than like $600 for the year for the NHS. And so I decided to do it. I was only going to do it for 2 years, but I've extended my stay. And my parents have realized, as Beth has, that I think that this is it for me. if they'll let me stay.
So was this visa a set term when you got it? Because honestly, the first time I had ever heard of it was when you mentioned it. And I thought, this is so cool. I didn't even know it was out there. Was it a set term of 2 years and you were able to somehow extend that, or how did that end up work that you get to still be there now?
So the visa can be either from 1 to 5 years. You decide. And I originally did 2, not to freak my parents out. And also because I got approved for the Arts Council endorsement in January 2020. And I was supposed to move. And then something called COVID started happening. And I was like, everything was so uncertain. So I just did the 2 years. And I re-upped it for 4 more years because, fun fact, once you've been in residence for 5 years in the UK, you can apply for something called indefinite leave to remain, which means I just have to apply to be able to just stay here. Someone told me it's not indefinite, it's just 10 years at a time. Also, after 5 years, you can apply for citizenship if I decide to do that as well. So my visa is long enough now that I hit the 5-year mark, and then I can decide. I'll most likely do indefinite leave to remain first.
Wow.
Oh my God. I'm so jealous.
Just so cool. I think it's just one of those things that until you hear about it, it just never crosses your mind that it's something you can do and that you can use this writing career where we have a lot of flexibility. It's one of the perks of this kind of a job, but you can use that to launch yourself into this really new and exciting adventure. I think it's just the kind of thing that people are going to hear about and be like, wait a minute. There are all these possibilities I just never thought about.
I have gotten a lot of emails, a lot of questions from author friends being like, how are you there? How did this happen? It's been great.
It's like a well-kept secret. Do you have tons of people who want to visit you suddenly because you're in this cool place?
Oh my goodness. It's amazing. I did joke like, wow, I became super popular once I decided I was moving to London. And I'm actually really grateful that there was, what, like 18 months that people couldn't come. This summer I stopped counting at 28 people who were coming into town. Yeah. And I finally had to kind of just say no to some people. I mean, the good thing about being an author and being on social media is you connect with people. The bad thing is there are a lot of people who think they know you when they actually don't. And so I did have to kind of draw some lines and realize I'm only one person. And if you actually are not a friend of mine, you know, IRL, you know, like, or I have my personal emails, like, you know, it's the thing where I just kind of, you know, it got to be a little bit too much.
I had that same experience when I moved to San Francisco. Suddenly I had people who I didn't even know asking if they could use my spare bedroom. And for a while I said yes to everybody. And then I was like, wait a minute, we don't even know each other. And so no, let's just stop all this. And that was kind of pre-social media. So I can't imagine how many people are knocking at your door saying, tell me what I'm supposed to do here, because people show up as tourists and they're clueless and they want your guidance. And all of that takes time and energy on your part.
Oh, you won't be surprised as writers. I wrote a document. So I have a document. When someone's like, I'm coming to London, I'm like, here you go.
That's actually a really good idea, right? Like, please, this is all I got for you. Please don't ask me anything else. That is amazing. Well, I could sit here and talk about traveling in London all day long. But we do have writing and book related questions that we want to hit you with while we have you. So Lisa, you were going to do question number one, right?
Yes. Hi, Elizabeth.
I haven't said yet. Thank you for having me on this podcast. I'm really excited. I listened to it, long time listener, first time guest.
Thank you. We love having you. We love doing the podcast because we get to hang out with people who have interesting stuff to say, which is so great. It's like my favorite thing right now. I think I'm going to just actually give up writing and just do podcasting because it's so much more fun and having a better time doing it.
So I'm going to jump into the first question. So you've written for young adults and middle grade readers. How did you make the jump from one to the other? What advice would you give to authors who want to try writing for another age group or genre?
Yes, I think it was my first six books were young adult, and that was where my focus was. But as we know with authors, it's important to diversify your writing. And I started having friends write middle grade and really enjoy it. And I started reading more middle grade. And I was trying to think of if I had an idea to do a middle grade because I wanted to try to challenge myself to do another genre. And I came up with the idea for the Shelby Holmes series. And it was such a change for me because not only was it a younger age group, it was a mystery. And all my YAs have been, you know, contemporary, like rom-com books. And so I gave myself two challenges. But what I did before I started writing middle grade, which I know has been mentioned many times on your podcast, is to read, 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 and read. I was doing a book event and I was in a bookstore, one of my favorite bookstores, Children's Book World in Haverford, Pennsylvania. And I said to Heather, who I just love, I said to her, I'm thinking of writing middle grade. Just tell me what to read. And she handed me like a stack of books. I think I even told her it was going to be like a Sherlock Holmes inspired. And I just started reading a lot. And it's funny because with Scared Silly, I'm even branching off more into doing like horror, so supernatural stuff, which I've never done before either. And what I like about middle grade is you have to keep, as you both know, you have to keep the action going. You know, in YA, you're allowed to luxuriate in feelings a bit longer, but you don't want to have kids be bored. So it kind of challenged me to really plot things out and to keep it a page turner, to have a lot of twists and turns, which I hadn't done before. And so it's really, I think, writing middle grade has made me a better writer overall.
Yeah. It is an interesting thing when you do like read back and forth. Like so I'm mainly middle grade. I love middle grade. I've written chapter book, but middle grade's my sweet spot. And so whenever I venture off into another genre, I'm just like, wow, this is taking a long time to move things forward. Like what? And then I find, and it's just like, it's a good book, you know, but it's just, I'm so conditioned to middle grade where everything, there's a huge cliffhanger at every end of every chapter. And it just, everything moves so quickly that that's where my attention span is. So that must have been an interesting shift for you to go the other direction.
And to be honest, the thing that scared me the most about switching to middle grade is everybody kept saying, oh, you're gonna have to do so many school visits. Oh, you have to do so many school visits. And I was used to going to high schools where, you know, people are like looking at me with like, you know, bored, dead behind the eyes because they're forced to listen to, you know, they need to be cool. And I remember the first time I did a visit for the first Shelby Holmes book and just this like little third grader in the front row looked at me and she goes, you wrote a book. And I said, yes, I wrote a book. That's so cool. You're my favorite author. And I was like, this is great. Because when you go into these like third, fourth, fifth graders, they just go in expecting to have the greatest time of their life because they're not in math class and hearing someone talk. And it's great. They also don't know how to lie and be polite. So if they tell you, if they've read your book and they tell you they like it, they're doing it because they mean it, you know, like they just don't know yet. You're just supposed to be like, oh no, it was an interesting read. Thank you. You know? Yeah.
I've had a couple funny experiences like that where like, I remember one time I was reading, I read like a chapter of my chapter book to these kids in the library. And this one kid just said, can you read something that's not so dumb?
Oh my gosh.
I just started laughing. I was like, oh my God, you were like the best reviewer ever. And then like on the other end of the spectrum, I had a school visit where I was walking up and this never happens, but they had already, this class, they had already read the book. And as I was walking up to the school, I could hear kids on the playground chanting my name. And I'm like, this is what Lindsay Curry must feel like at every school visit.
Now it's my favorite part about writing for middle grade is doing the school visits. It's just, it's so much fun and the energy and they're just, they're great.
They are very, very cute. Well, that was good to hear because we hear from a lot of people who want to switch from what they're doing to something else. And I think like you said, and like many of our guests have said, you just need to read. You need to just sort of immerse yourself in that space so that you know what you're doing, because there are rules there that are, you know, spoken and unspoken that you need to follow if you're going to write in a certain space. So I think just to remind everybody, go get your stack of books and start reading. I mean, it's not a bad thing to have to do. So, you know, as medicine, it's pretty okay. So next question, you wrote the Great Shelby Home series. And I love that one because it was funny in the way that the thing I love about middle grade books is that humor. The character's fun and funny and you're just sucked into it. But I read somewhere, and I can't remember where, that you have some personal connections to Sherlock Holmes.
So when the TV show Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch came out, I had so many friends say, oh, you need to watch this show. You're going to love it. It's like modern day London. And I was like, nah, I don't like Sherlock Holmes. And my friends were like, who doesn't like Sherlock Holmes? That's so weird. I was like, nah, don't like Sherlock Holmes. And the reason why I grew up not liking Sherlock Holmes is because whenever I tell this story at school, I always say to kids, I was like, who has an older sibling? And when they raise their hands, I go, well, I don't need to go on, but I will. But so I'm the youngest of four. And I am the musical one in my family. I played the, you know, piano, guitar, clarinet. And so anytime my school had a musical, I would usually have a lead role. And so sixth grade, my tiny Catholic school did a Sherlock Holmes musical. And there were no female parts because apparently women didn't exist in the late 1800s. And so all of the girls in school were in the choir. We were like the Baker Street Irregulars. We had like page boy hats and like, you know, we sang. And my brother was Sherlock Holmes, who is not musical at all. And his best friend was Watson. And because I'm in sixth grade, I, of course, decided to take this out on Sherlock Holmes for the, like, any normal, like, what, I'm 11, 12. I was like, I don't like Sherlock Holmes. He's dumb. And so I literally just ignored anything Sherlock Holmes. And then so many people told me to watch the show. And I remember there was a big blizzard in New York. And I was like, well, I'm not going anywhere. I guess I'll watch an episode. And then I was like, it's 90 minutes. Like, I was angry that this show is 90 minutes. But I started watching it. And within the first 10 minutes, I was like, oh my gosh, Elizabeth. Because especially the way Benedict Cumberbatch plays Sherlock Holmes, he plays him like a spoiled, petulant child. You know, like, I don't want to have to play with anybody and I don't have to share anything. And within the first 10 minutes, I was like, I now remember why we are still talking about Sherlock Holmes 150 plus years after Sir Arthur Conan Doyle first wrote about him, is because not only did he look at things that no one else did regarding forensic psychology, is that he had a really bad attitude. And I'm not kidding. Like minute 15, I was like, huh, what if Sherlock Holmes was a 9-year-old girl? I mean, that was it, like, right away. And then I was like, well, I guess I'm into the Sherlock Holmes. And then I, you know, did a deep dive. Besides watching the Sherlock Holmes, I read a lot of the original stories. I read a lot of nonfiction. I read Sherlock Holmes for Dummies. And then I also read, I love the Dummies books. Like, I put that up when I do schools and kids look at me. I'm like, no, it's great. I read Forensics for Dummies and Forensic Psychology for Dummies and went in. And so I just think it's funny that for so many decades, I ignored Sherlock Holmes solely because I was jealous my brother got the lead part.
I loved that show for just the reasons that you said. I mean, you just want to slap Benedict Cumberbatch in the face, like, stop being an insolent little brat. Like, he plays it so perfectly. And it was not a common portrayal. It's hard to find a portrayal like that in, you know, the many, many movies and interpretations that have happened in the past. So it and I too had that 90 minute thing where I was like, wait, is this a movie? Is it a show? Is it what? And then it would come out sporadically. So it always had you feeling a little off because you couldn't predict when the next episode would show up and their lengths were all over the place. Yeah, that's funny that that's the thing that kind of sparked it for you. But now that you say that, it makes sense, having read those books, there are a lot of similarities in that sort of character that you have in Shelby.
Because I watched the other, like a lot of different other interpretations of Sherlock Holmes TV and movie adaptations. And a lot of times Sherlock is portrayed very stuffy. He's very like stuffy and short. And Watson, especially in the movies with Basil Rathbone, the Watson is just a bumbling idiot. And so I wanted my Watson to be more involved like he is in the BBC adaptation.
Yeah. So you talk about being out of your comfort zone, that it helps you to be a better writer. Can you give us an example of how relocating to London has influenced your writing? And I'm curious, especially with the Shelby Home books, did your habits, your writing habits or routine change being in this new place?
It's funny because I'm trying to remember what my writing habits were before COVID. Here, I'm someone who I like to go on walks and think about things before I sit down to write. And so when I moved here, it was fall of 2020, and we started getting into restrictions here a lot. And so there were times where I could only go for walks by myself. And it kind of didn't really change my workday because I would go in the morning for a walk. And here it was great because it's London. And so I started doing blue plaques. So blue plaques are these historical plaques they have on buildings of someone who significantly lived there. And so I went to go see where like Charles Dickens once lived and where Virginia Woolf lived. I finally, the other day, I was near it. So I went to saw where Jim Henson lived when he lived in London. I know it's very, I've been near there enough, but like this time I was like, I'm going early so I can just walk by and see the house. And there's always a blue plaque. So in the mornings, I would always think about what I'm going to write. And then I would sit in a park, and London has a bunch of different parks and pretty places and kind of outline and what I write. So, I mean, I guess I would go for walks in New York. Like, it's so funny that I can't remember what did I do beforehand? But yeah, I've developed a new routine where morning walk, sit, outline. I always have a notebook where I outline what I'm going to write. And then in the afternoon, as I do most of my writing, and it's my time to figure things out. And just because London inspires me so much, I look forward to the morning walk. I will say, I can't talk too much about upcoming projects. They haven't been announced yet, but two of the things that I'm working on do take place in London. And I've always been inspired. The funny thing is, and this is what was part of my letter to the Arts Council of reasons why I benefit from, why I would benefit from being here, is three things that I've written have been inspired by British culture. The Beatles were inspired my first book. I did a retelling of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice called Prom and Prejudice. And then, you know, Shelby Holmes and Sherlock Holmes. So I do find a lot of inspiration with British culture. So that at least got me here.
I love that you can draw links to your writing to London. I mean, this almost feels like it was meant to be, like you had to go there, right? Because it's just kind of plugged into your writing DNA.
Yeah. And it's funny because when I first moved here, it's back when you had to do the 14-day quarantine. So I couldn't leave the flat. And when I tell people that, they go, okay. And then I say, no, they actually deactivated the fob. So even if I tried to leave the building, I wouldn't be let back in. And they're like, oh, I'm like, I don't know what part of I couldn't leave the flat for 14 days. But I have a view of the London Eye. And I was asked while I was in the middle of my quarantine by Marissa Meyer, author. She was doing an anthology, a rom-com anthology called Serendipity, out now. And she was like, oh, would you be interested in taking part? We're going to do a little twist on tropes. And I was like, yeah. And I look at the London Eye. I'm like, I'm going to do one where the London Eye is this big, almost Ferris wheel like thing. And it's a 30-minute journey up and around. And I was like, I'm going to do Trapped in the London Eye. So I was like, yeah, it was funny. I just like right away, I was like, sure. And then I was like, you know what? Looking out the window, there's inspiration kind of everywhere, which is great, especially when I've been doing this for over 10 years now. So get all the inspiration one can get.
Yeah. I was in London with the kids in, I think, 2018, and when they were younger, and I ended up writing, I think it's the third Mrs. Smith's book, takes place almost entirely in London, and they get stuck in the eye, and or they get, you know, they're stuck in the eye in one of those cars with the bad guy. And yeah, I mean, I feel like there's so much history there. There's so many links that you can make. It really is just kind of fires up your imagination. It's so cool. So our next question, kind of changing gears a little bit here. I've been thinking about this. I had a conversation with somebody recently where they asked me if I read reviews of my work. And I said, no, because I don't get anything out of them except that they, you know, by and large, make me feel bad, because you never really read the good ones and say, I'm fabulous. Instead, you read the bad ones and you're like, I'm terrible. So I thought I would ask you how you, you know, you've been in this business a long time. You've generated tons and tons of reviews. How do you handle the reviews, positive and negative?
Because I was a publicist first, and so I was the one usually sharing reviews with authors, and I have been in the bad position of having to share a really bad review with authors. I mean, only if it's a major publication and they're going to be aware of it. What I would always say when people talk about reviews is I'm like, you know, look at your favorite book in the entire world and go on Goodreads. There will be 1-star reviews. I think of the book like Book Thief by Marcus Zusak, which is a brilliant, amazing book. It's got 1-star reviews on Goodreads. Like, I don't know what book these people were reading. I always look at it as there's not one book that exists in the world that everybody loves. Now, it's easy for me to say that. And then when you're the one writing it, it's different. And I wasn't sure how I was going to handle reviews once I became an author. You know, editors will send me the trade reviews or of significant reviews. And I know certain things, like for those out there, there's a publication called Kirkus, and they are known for giving very, very nasty reviews. Like even a book that they love, there's always like a little bit of a dig. I always know to brace myself and kind of go, well, it's Kirkus, when they say the one thing. It's just kind of their style. I would like to say I take it pretty well. Like I generally stay off of Goodreads. I will, if I know the arcs of a book of mine are out, I do kind of want to just see what people are thinking, but I won't after a book has come out. Because with arcs, you know, the people who are reading it are mostly reviewers of some kind or in the industry, aren't someone who just wants to give you a 1-star review because they don't like something you posted on Twitter. I feel like I take it pretty well. I have been fortunate to get some good reviews and some not good ones. And at the end of the day, I like the books that I write, and I know that there's an audience for them. And it might not be for everybody. I will say, though, I do love with like really mean reviews, though, because it's clearly not about the book. There's something else going on. And I think what happened was my first book was called The Lonely Hearts Club. And it's about a girl who decides to stop dating guys in high school because they're not worth the trouble. And it's very, I mean, lessons are learned, right? But it's very like, go women, boys are dumb. And I had a Facebook page and some boy posted on it, you're the worst thing that's ever happened in the world. And I just laughed because I'm sure what happened was he was dating some girl who read my book or something, right? And friends are like, oh my gosh, I saw what was, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, no, I'm fine. You know, like I had this thing I won't go into that I got bullied really badly and Reddit happened with these like male people of fans of a very specific thing ganged up on me. And they were like calling me fat and ugly and, you know, telling me I should kill myself. And I was just like, okay, you know, words matter and I'm not going to do anything harmful to myself because I'm a grown woman. But maybe you shouldn't be saying those words. But I know that that's not aimed at me, that they're mad that I had an opinion of something that they didn't enjoy, that somebody who's fighting something else. So I do try to keep a pretty level head. I say that now, I'm going to probably get off and be shown a horrible review of Zombie Wedding Crashers and then cry. But I like that book though. I will say once I saw like a 2-star review of my book, Better Off Friends. And I was like, no, this book's better than 2 stars.
This is one of my kids' books and it got a 1-star review because Amazon sent them the wrong book. So, yeah. You know, those sorts of things. I mean, the bullying stuff is so unfortunate and people are just off their rockers lately. But I feel like there's a lot of the trade reviews are one category. The end user reviews are a different category because again, they're like, I don't like the cover or my book came with a tear in it. And then it's 1-star review for you. There's no connection that they make between what they're doing and their reviewing and its impact on the author. I read trade reviews. I stopped reading end user reviews like right after my first book came out because I figured out pretty quickly that there was nothing I could learn from them that was valuable. You know, the trade reviews, you can get a sense of like, okay, so maybe I missed the mark a little on this, or this is how this is being interpreted. I'll keep that in mind. It's a professional reading. But the end users, you're like, I can't do anything with this. It's just noise.
And I also worked with authors who had long-standing series and would let the the you know, their fans, like their criticisms of the series get to them. And, you know, there's, especially when something becomes super successful, there's not anything an author at that point could write that's going to appease everybody. It's what happens.
Yeah. And your super fans take it all really personally.
Yeah. But I will also say it's interesting because when I give my books to people to read, when I'm like, you know, working through drafts, I don't want to hear it. It's fine. Like I want my book to be ripped to shreds because that's when it's helpful. That's when I can do something about it, when I want the help and I need the help.
And then once it's done, it's done. I can't fix it. So I don't need to know that, you know, you had some problem with what was in it because I can't change it now. It's on to the next thing.
Well, and I think the thing is that if you're not going to believe the best thing, you're going to believe the worst thing that's said about you, but you're not going to believe the best thing that's said about you. And so what is that doing to your mental health? It's true. It's just, you're going to remember the one bad review more than the good one.
Yeah. You could have 100 glowing reviews and then somebody says, hey, you suck. And that's the only takeaway that you have. You're like, I suck. They said so. Those other 100 people. Who cares?
No, don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I think we're all neurotic. Lisa, you want to do the last question?
So you have a new series coming out. Tell us about it and when does it hit the shelves?
So my newest series is called Scared Silly. I mentioned it earlier. It's my take on like the horror genre kind of, but it's more funny than frightening. And it is about a long dormant witch's curse in this town of Cauldron's Cove that these four kids have to have. There's like a monster of the week for each book. And so they have to defeat the curse. And the second book just came out called Zombie Wedding Crashers. The third book, Vampires Ruin Everything, comes out on January 2nd, 2024. And what's interesting, and I thought to mention just briefly, because there are a lot of aspiring, you know, writers who listen to this, that when people write series, the question we always get, well, how many books will there be? And right now there are 3 books in the Scared Silly series. Hopefully there's more, but we have to see how the book does. And I am guilty as anybody that I read the first book in a series and then I don't read the rest. So right now I leave the third book kind of in a, maybe things will be better or maybe they won't, but with the hope that there'll be more creatures. But it's this thing where it depends on numbers. And right now, because it's the fall when we're recording this, is, you know, the scary season, the second book's out. We're waiting on school mark. There's a lot of factors. And so it's always such a hard thing. I know, Beth, you've done series before when people ask about, well, how many? Because that happened with Shelby, is that there were 4. There could have been more, but just the series kind of had its natural progression sales wise. So if you want, so this is my way to say, if you really love a series and you want to continue, you need to buy or at least like review online all of the books and tell people about it. Because most authors, unless there's like a planned trilogy or duology, would like series, especially for middle graders, to continue and continue.
That's really true. And I remember pitching my last series, which was a Simon & Schuster series, and the publisher seeing that they were backing off of series because of exactly why you just said. People read the first one, maybe the second one, and then they take a precipitous drop in sales. And they were leaning more into standalones. So I remember that. I remember thinking to myself, isn't this all just a big circle? Because when I started writing, it was series or bust. You better be pitching a series or nobody's going to look at it. So I mean, there's obviously room for both, but I think, yes, if you like a series, you know, vote with your purchase of the book or asking for it at the library or however it is that you do it, because otherwise, you know, it's not sustainable. There are also those writers who get to book 3 and they're like, I never want to see these stupid characters ever again. And I've had that happen to me too, where the publisher's like, let's go. And I'm like, let's not go. Let's just be done. This is perfectly positioned for the spooky season. And Lisa writes spooky middle grade. I know that spooky middle grade is huge right now. So I think you are very well positioned and hopefully we'll see many more of these coming out.
Thank you. No, it's been fun. And also, you know, being writers and being able to count like research, being able to watch like horror movies and silly horror movies. I was like, oh, I got to go to work now. has been a lot of fun. But also, you know, now writing about London, I'm like, oh, I got to go to high tea. I have to have high tea for research. So I think the most important thing of being a writer is write what you love.
Yeah, that's true. And write the things that get you to take really awesome vacations and trips.
Yeah.
So anyway, we have kept you a long time and it's nighttime in London. So thank you so much for being here and sharing all of this wisdom. I know that our readers are going to find really good takeaways in this conversation.
Thank you both so much for having me. It's been fun. I love talking to writers about writing.
Good. And remember, everybody out there, you can find out more about Elizabeth and her books on her website, which is elizabethyulberg.com. And I'll put links to all her socials on the podcast notes so you can easily get in touch if you'd like to. And you did say you were coming back to the States for school visits. You're probably all booked up for that. But if there are interested educators out there, get in touch with you and maybe your next round you can get on the schedule.
Yes. And I'm also available for virtual visits as well.
Right. I keep forgetting that those are a thing, right? That's all we did for so long. And then it was like, nope, no more of that. And as always, thank you listeners for tuning in. Please visit our link tree or the podcast notes and find out how to support the show by subscribing, following, and recommending. And we will see you again next week, October 9th. For a top 5 deep dive episode. We have a really good one teed up for you, so we hope you join us for that. And until then, happy reading, writing, and listening.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of Writers with Wrinkles. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. This helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode.